I computed for you the masses of the W and Z bosons. And so this is pretty clear. We should just try and figure out whether they're there. So W and Z bosons decay to two fermions. And so therefore, they can be produced in the annihilation of two fermions. So for example, the Z in the process E plus E minus to Z, or QQ bar going to Z, and the W in processes like UD bar going to W plus. And of course, it didn't escape your attention when I showed you plots of the E plus E minus cross-section in one of the first lectures, that there was this enormous unexplained peak at 91 GeV. Well, that's the Z. I also showed you a plot of the Drell-Yan cross-section in an earlier lecture, where it obeyed the usual regularity, but then there was some large peak at 91 GeV. And that's, again, the Z appearing in the process, P plus going to mu plus mu minus, where these guys have the mass of the Z. It's pretty clear that from both of these reactions, you can measure the mass of the Z quite accurately. Because, for example, here, you just measure the mass of the mu plus mu minus system. And wherever it peaks, that's where the particle is. For the W, it's a little trickier to find the particle. Because in a hadron collider, you would observe the W by its decay, let's say, into electron neutrino or muon neutrino. And the neutrino is missing. So if we're going to talk about how you check experimentally the mass of the W, we'll have to talk a little about this system. So first of all, I should just tell you that these particles were actually discovered in this way in PP bar collisions at the CERN PP bar collider, the first proton-antiproton high-energy collider, at the very end of 1982. I think the slides, page 2, by the way, there are lots of slides today, so please get them down. The slides, page 2, show LEGO plots of two electron neutrino events and two, in the bottom, two E plus E minus events. Oh, somehow that came out backwards, didn't it? Yeah, OK, good. Show LEGO plots of two E plus E minus of E neutrino events and two E plus E minus events. The events on the LEGO plot are just amazingly clean. I mean, basically, the only thing you see are the leptons. And in the top two, you see very clearly that there's missing momentum opposite to the lepton, which would be the neutrino, which is carried away. Now, the problem is that if you don't observe the neutrino, it seems like you can't measure the mass of the W. So needless to say, there is a trick for this, and I'd like to explain it to you. We're going to now ignore the electron mass and the neutrino mass. So that being so, I can parametrize the electron momentum in the following way. I first write the transverse momentum. Then, if the electron were going precisely transverse to the beam, that would basically be all there is, and the energy would be equal to the transverse momentum. If I boost this, I can parametrize the boost in terms of the electron rapidity, and I would write this expression, and that expression has ke squared equals 0. Let's write the similar expression for the neutrino. Oh, now there's something I should have told you. I'll wake up sooner or later. In these PP bar events, you have particles that are sprayed all over the place. You have the high energy, in this case, positron. And the neutrino goes off in some direction like that. So if you measure the momentum depositions in the detector, you can rather accurately measure the transverse components of the neutrino momentum. However, when the protons disrupt each other, a lot of the partons in the proton go forward, which is to say, right down the beam pipe. And the detector only subtends a finite solid angle. So anything that goes very far forward is missed. So typically, you can measure transverse momentum balance, but you can't measure longitudinal momentum balance. And so the problem is that you know some of this four vector. You know its transverse component, but you don't know its longitudinal component. So what I'm showing you now is a trick to somehow recover that information. OK, so here are these two vectors. So let's now construct the vector of the W. So that's equal to the sum of these two vectors, which would, oh, sorry, that's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to construct the mass of the W, which is ke plus k nu squared, which, because they're massless, is ke dot k nu. Now we're on the right track. And if I dot these two vectors together, I'll obviously get kte kt nu times cosh cosh sinh sinh is the cosh of a to e minus a to nu minus kte dot kt nu. Now I'd like to observe that this is greater than or equal to the quantity kte kt nu minus kte dot kt nu, which now contains only transverse information. And so if we define the transverse mass of the W as, sorry, there should be a 2 here and a 2 here, as this quantity, then this quantity is a strict lower bound to the actual mass of the W. And so if I now measure this for a lot of events and see where the upper bound of the MTW distribution is, that should be the W mass. Now, usually there's a little overrun. First of all, because the W has a finite width, it's unstable. And second, just because detectors aren't perfect and there's some mismeasurement. But in practice, what happens is that the distribution of this quantity has a very sharp fall off exactly at the W mass. So if you go to the next slide, what you'll see is the transverse mass distributions measured by the CDF experiment at Fermilab. And you see that they're all bunched up toward the high end, and then they fall off very sharply just at about 80 GeV. So that's the mass of the W. And actually, now, if you try and put in all the effects that go into that distribution, and then you can calibrate by doing the same analysis with the E plus E minus events from the Z, and use the very accurate value of the Z mass, which I'm going to explain to you in about 10 or 15 minutes, then what comes out of this analysis is a very accurate value of the W mass, 80.376. with a 33 MeV error. So we really know what the W mass is extremely well. I gotta wake up. That's another number, 31. Now, another way to measure the W mass is to go to E plus E minus. And if you have enough energy in E plus E minus, you can run the reaction E plus E minus to W pairs. And the W, as we're about to compute in detail, can decay either to a lepton in the neutrino or to something like UD bar or CS bar. And so it can have both leptonic and hadronic decays. And in this process, then, you'll see all four types of events. Leptonic on both sides, so-called semi-leptonic, where it's leptonic on one side and QQ bar on the other side, and then events where it's entirely hadronic, so then there are just four quark jets in the final state. So because you might be curious, I put on the next three slides actual events that were taken at the LEP collider at CERN by the Delphi and Opal experiments. And the first one is a one that's leptonic on both sides, so you just see these two beautiful lepton tracks. The second one is one which is leptonic on one side with two jets. And the third one, this is figure six, has four jets. Whenever the W decays to two jets, you can add up the momenta of those jets, and you get the W mass. And so then if I just do that, I should get a beautiful peak. And on the next slide, this is figure seven, you see some of those peaks, I think, measured by Opal. And in a very beautiful way, they peak at 80 GeV. And the number that's obtained from the LEP experiments is the number that I meant to write down, is that I actually wrote down here, which is 80.376 plus or minus 0.33, which within the errors is totally consistent with this one. And so the W, we really know where it is, and it's in exactly the place that the theory I told you yesterday predicted it should be. Okay, I'd like to now compute the W width and branching ratios. So this is some information which actually is also tested. And the W branching ratios are very important to know because any heavier thing that we'll create, for example, at the LHC, for example, the top quark, will probably decay to W's. And so we'll have to know more or less everything there is to know about the W in order to be able to recover that particle and analyze it. Yes? Okay, a branching ratio is the fraction of all decays that go into the mode you're talking about. So let me illustrate these things by actually computing all these things for the W. It's a pretty straightforward computation given the methods we've developed. So let's first compute the matrix element for the W to decay to E plus nu. So that's the coupling constant is G over root 2. There's a V bar, or rather a U bar for the neutrino, a gamma mu, a V for the positron. These are left-handed, and that gets dotted into the polarization vector of the W. So in the W rest frame, these guys are in their center of mass frame. So that's something I computed for you in the first week of the course. It's the square root of 2 times 2e, which is just mw, times this epsilon L vector. And that gets dotted into the polarization vector of the W. So now if you square that, you get g squared mw squared times epsilon L dot epsilon of W. And if I sum this over W polarizations, this is just going to give 1. So now the decay rate of the W is 1 over 2 mw phase space, 1/3 of the sum over W polarizations, the square of the amplitude. And as I said, the sum over epsilon here is 1. So that all works out to something very simple, g squared over, 48 pi mw and nothing else. Let me call this, for convenience, alpha weak over 6 mw. And alpha weak is equal to 1 over 4 pi. Alpha weak is equal to g squared over 4 pi. So that's e squared over 4 pi sine squared theta w. The numerical value is 1 over 29.6. That's easy to remember. OK. Now, for electrons, muons, and taus, this is exactly the right set of equations. If I have quarks, then I have to multiply by the color factor of 3. If we're being very accurate, I should probably include the leading order QCD correction, which it turns out is 1 plus alpha s over pi which is about a 4%, positive 4% correction. So this number is actually 3.1. So the total width of the W would then be alpha W MW over 6 times 3 times 1 for E mu and tau, plus 2 for UD and S and C, times this number 3.1. And if you multiply all those numbers and put them all together, it turns out to be 2.1 GeV. So the W isn't narrow. And in fact, when I showed you those Opal plots, a lot of the width is actually the intrinsic width of the W. Nevertheless, you can locate the center of that position with very high statistics. Then finally, the branching ratios. So this is the process. These are the processes that we're interested in. The branching ratios are just the relative size of individual terms here relative to the whole. And so for E, mu, and tau, the branching ratio is equal to 11%. For these guys, the branching ratio is equal to 34%. And give or take the third decimal place, that'll all add up to 100%. OK. W's easy. One more thing. You remember I told you that when you have the gamma for the decay from a resonance to a two-body final state, you can basically reverse everything and get the cross-section for the two particles to produce the resonance. And for the W, that formula, you can easily work it out, is sigma UD bar to produce a W plus is pi squared alpha W over 3 times the delta function at the resonance position. So if you, for example, integrate this formula with parton distributions, you can figure out what the cross-section is to produce W's. This will be some, it's a large cross-section. It's tens of nanobarns at the Tevatron, hundreds of nanobarns at the LHC. Yes? Lowest order, oh, I'm sorry, because I've omitted the width? Yes, it's the narrow width approximation. Okay. We'll need to do a little better on this for the Z, so just wait a minute. Okay, well now we can just repeat all these calculations for the Z. And let's see, let me not get ahead of myself here. So for the Z, the couplings are not so simple because they depend on all these factors that I wrote down that I was talking about yesterday. QZ is equal to the weak isospin minus sine squared theta W times the charge. And the weak isospin depends on whether it's left or right. And the charge, of course, takes all kinds of funny values, like 2/3 for an up quark. So these numbers are all over the map. So just so you can keep track of them, on the next slide in the figures, there's a handy-dandy table of the Z charges. And so you need to think about nu, E, U, and D, and then left and right. And for each of those, there's a separate answer, except for the right-handed neutrino, for which that charge is 0, and maybe it doesn't even exist. So for example, for the U left, the Z charge, which I'll call QZ left, is a half minus 2/3 sine squared theta W. And for the right-handed U, the charge is minus 2/3 sine squared theta W. Now, there are two combinations of these charges that are very useful. And we're going to talk about them a lot as I go through the next part of the lecture. And those are, I call SF and AF. So SF is the sum of the squares of the charges. And AF is the asymmetry of the charges, defined in this way. So the SFs will tell you, for example, the total rate for the Z to decay into an up quark. Yes?
Does it matter what theta W is evaluated at?
Yes, it does. It does.
No, for SF?
Yes.
Okay, then, because this table doesn't list SF as a function of theta W, so.
Sorry, so that's right. So in the table, I put sine squared theta W equals 0.231. We're going to get the third digit in just a minute. Okay. So in the table, I listed these numbers for kind of the best current value of sine squared theta W. But I showed you yesterday sine squared theta W is close to 0.23. So these are reasonable numbers. So the SFs tell you basically what is the total rate for the Z to decay to that species, counting left and right. The AFs are something different. The AFs tell you what is the asymmetry between the rate to make a left-handed guy and the rate to make a right-handed guy. And because these couplings are different, there'll be a different rate, and the rate will actually have a different asymmetry depending on the species. And it's interesting that these AFs are all over the map. They're, of course, 100% for neutrinos. It's a 15% asymmetry for leptons. It's an almost maximal asymmetry for down-type quarks. And we'll come back to this point, because this is something very interesting to try and test experimentally. Okay, so now I have on the board some formulae for the W, and the kinematics of Z decay are very similar to the kinematics of W decay, so I can just tell you how these formulae change for the W. For example, for Z0 goes to E minus E plus with a left-handed electron, I can just copy that formula. I need to supply here a factor of cosine theta W, and the root 2 goes away. Yeah, I screwed up. As usual, there should be a 12. I'm sorry. Really, I'll drink my tea. I'll wake up. The formulae are correct in the lecture notes on the web, by the way. Okay, so this factor changes to this one. I also have to supply a QZL for the electron. When I square this, I get QZL plus QZR. And so the partial width for Z to E plus E minus is equal to the same formula as here, alpha W. There's a 6 instead of a 12. There's a cosine squared theta W. And then in here, the SF will appear. And then I also have to multiply by this factor of 3.1 if I have a quark. So now we can compute the total width of the Z and the branching ratios. The total width of the Z is this prefactor. Okay, so first of all, 3 neutrinos. So they contribute, according to the table, 0.25. 3 leptons, so they contribute 0.126. 2 up quarks, because the top quark is too heavy to be produced at the Z. So they contribute 0.144 here. And 3 minus 2% down quarks, I'll explain that in a moment, times 1.85. And then I have to multiply this whole thing by 3.1. Good. And then if you multiply all those numbers together, what you get is 2.49. GeV. So once again, the Z has a significant width, a little larger than that of the W. And if you compute the branching ratios for these various species, you can do that just again by taking each of these numbers divided by the whole. And so what you will find then is for neutrinos, 6.7% per species of neutrino. For electrons, for e mu tau, 3.3%. For u, 11.9%. The same for the charm quark. For d, 15.3%. And once again, if you add up all the numbers, you get 100%. So that's what a branching ratio is. Okay. A very interesting observation here is that this number turns out to be 170 MeV per neutrino. So we don't see the neutrinos, but we can actually see them in the width of the Z. And if we make a very accurate measurement of the width of the Z, we can actually measure the number of light neutrinos into which the Z decays. So you would think if you're quite good, you could exclude an extra neutrino. So we'll see if that's true. Okay, so now how do we measure the width of the Z? Well, what we need to do is to produce the Z in some very benign environment and very carefully measure the shape of the cross-section as we go over the Z. So from these formulae here, I could get the E plus E minus cross-section to make the Z. And so that, using the formula I gave you before, is 2 pi squared alpha W SF for the electron times delta of S hat minus MZ, or S minus MZ in this case. Actually, I guess as Ross pointed out, this isn't quite good enough if I want to really talk about an accurate cross-section measurement. The first thing I should do is replace this. So this is what would happen if you had q squared minus mz squared in the propagator. But probably I should include the width in the propagator. It goes in here like this, and then I have to square this. And when I square it, I get the famous Breit-Wigner formula, which is S minus MZ squared, squared plus MZ gamma Z squared. And then this should be normalized to a delta function. So there's MZ gamma Z over pi in the numerator. OK. So now I predict the cross-section shape that's roughly like this, a symmetrical Breit-Wigner curve with a full width at half maximum equal to gamma, and the resonance position at MZ. Okay. Well, now, unfortunately, this still isn't right, because this is just for a bare E plus hitting a bare E minus. But for electrons radiating photons, just as we studied in detail last week, for quarks radiating gluons, there's initial state radiation. That is, when the electrons come in to make the Z, they could first radiate some photons. Their energy could decrease, and that will correspond, that will make the resonance position appear at a slightly higher center of mass energy. And if you really want to be accurate, you should probably include multiple radiation from both sides and other radiative corrections. And now this becomes a serious enterprise. But for the experiments that were done, so in the early 90s, accelerators at SLAC and at CERN, the original version of LEP, did very precise experiments where you run E plus E minus just at the Z energy. Actually, we've seen a lot of data from those experiments already in the QCD part of this course. You want a very accurate cross-section. And so people went to great pains to actually calculate all these things to order alpha squared plus all the logarithms, summing up all those alpha times logarithm terms. And then you get a very accurate theory of this initial state radiation. So what it does to this curve is that, first of all, it pushes the maximum to a slightly larger center of mass energy. And then it also causes it to slough over at the high end and become asymmetric. So on the next slide, which is page 9, there's a curve that shows you the measured shape of the Z as measured at LEP, and then the ideal shape of the Z that you obtain by removing this process and going back, theoretically, to the bright figure. The very impressive thing about this curve is that there's a little note that says that the error bars are multiplied by a factor of 10 so that you can see them. And if you just turn the page, what you'll see is a more detailed measurement of the line shape from Opal. And you see there's just incredibly beautiful agreement between the theoretical formula for the line shape generated by this calculation and the experimental formula. From that, you can extract the mass and width of the Z. The number for the width turns out to be, I think, 2.495. And actually, let me quote the complete number. 2 with an accuracy of 2.3 MeV. And the number for the mass, there's a whole story about the mass of the Z, which unfortunately I don't have time to tell you. But the mass of the Z is determined in these experiments to be 91.1875 plus or minus 0.0021 GeV. So this is actually one of the, like the Fermi constant that I told you about yesterday, this is one of the best measured numbers in physics. Okay. So now, I told you here that neutrinos contribute 170 MeV to the width. This is the right number within a couple MeV. And so what you see is that we're not only ruling out an extra neutrino, we're ruling out like 2% of a neutrino. So if you extract the number of neutrinos from these measurements, the number that you get is the number of light neutrinos into which the Z decays is 2.98. Actually, they quote some more significant figures, plus or minus 0.008. So there could be heavy neutrinos. There could be neutrinos that have zero coupling to the Z, so-called sterile neutrinos. But the neutrinos that are in doublets, there are three of them. And maybe there might be some very small additional contribution from an invisible thing to which the Z might decay. But you see, it's highly constrained by this measurement. OK. Oh, now there's one more thing I need to tell you about the Z width. And that is this number here. So I told you that the bottom quark only gets 98% of a quark contribution. And the reason for that is this, that there's another precision effect that one has to worry about for the bottom quark. We have this heavy top quark, and the top quark can affect the rate at which the Z decays to bottom quarks through these radiative corrections. And if you compute those diagrams, it gives a minus 2% correction to the width for the Z to decay to bottom quarks. And so you can ask, well, is that effect actually included? Can you measure it? Well, I told you early in the course about how you actually look in E plus E minus events to see if there are bottom quarks in them. You look for some displaced vertices. So if you have, as the LEP had, 12 million Z decays, you can get a very accurate idea from that technique. So actually, at LEP, they measured a quantity RB, which is the branching ratio for Z to go to BB bar divided by the branching ratio for Z to go to any hadronic final state. So you gather hadronic final states. You ask what fraction of them have these displaced vertices. The answer turns out to be 21629 plus or minus 0.00066. And this is to be compared to 0.216, roughly, with the standard model prediction, and 0.220 without the top quark correction. So actually, even this little wiggle on the standard model is actually observed at LEP and in good agreement with the standard model. OK, so now, hopefully, I've told you enough about the SFs. The numbers that are in that table really seem to be the right numbers, and there are many experimental checks that I've just described. Now, what about the AFs? Well, the AFs are another story, but it turns out that there, too, one can do experiments to see whether the values in nature agree with those in this table. So I'd like to tell you now three techniques for measuring AFs. The AFs, remember, as I said, are all over the map. So let's start with the leptons, for which the AF is supposed to be about 15%. So to measure the AF directly, we would have to make a Z, let it decay to fermion antifermion, and then measure the helicity of the fermion that comes out. So this is not so easy. I mean, for a quark, we don't even see the quark. So it's not obvious how we would like get our hands on that quark and measure the helicity. But there's one case where you can do the measurement directly, which is the tau lepton. The tau lepton has a rather short lifetime, a tenth of a picosecond. If it's boosted, it goes out to some millimeters away from the interaction point. The tau decays by weak interactions. And so they're parity-violating decays. So as I showed you for the case of mu to e, those decays are sensitive to the direction of the tau polarization. The tau decays to lots of things. And so then you have to kind of make a theory of tau decays and figure out how much each mode depends on the polarization. So for example, the branching ratios of the tau are tau to e and two neutrinos, or tau to mu and two neutrinos, is 18%. The tau can decay to a pion and a neutrino. That's 11%. The tau can decay to a rho and a neutrino, 26%. It decays to some heavier hadrons. All of these modes have very strong polarization asymmetries. And let me explain you the easiest one, which is the tau to nu, tau to pi. Now, we start out in the tau rest frame. And we have a tau in its rest frame polarized along the 3-axis. Now it's going to decay to a pion and a neutrino. Now, the pion is spinless. The neutrino, it's a weak interaction. It's always left-handed. So the neutrino spin is always pointing in that direction. And along this axis, that's the only thing that has angular momentum. So if I conserve angular momentum, I immediately get the following formula, that d gamma d cosine of this angle to the neutrino is proportional to 1 minus cosine theta. That is, the neutrino wants to go backwards so that its angular momentum is matched with the angular momentum of the tau. Okay. Now, the pion always goes in the other direction. So d gamma d cosine theta pion is 1 plus cosine theta. So for a right-handed tau, the pion goes forward. For a left-handed tau, the pion goes backward. OK, so now the tau, of course, is not at rest. It's produced in Z decay. So it's being kicked out at an energy of about 46 GeV. So that's a boost factor of something like 25. So we need to take the momenta in this frame and boost this situation very strongly in the forward direction. So the momentum of the pion is then now e pi p pi sine theta p pi cosine theta, where if we're boosting this way, the theta pi is this angle. Now, the pion's a lot lighter than the tau, so it's a pretty good approximation to set e pi approximately equal to p pi. And now if I take that vector and I boost it along the 3-axis, then I'll find that the energy of the pion in the lab is equal to the gamma by which I boost times e pi plus beta p pi times cosine theta. And gamma is 25, beta is very close to 1, p pi is very close to e. So this is approximately gamma times the e pi in the center of mass frame times 1 plus cosine theta, which is the same factor as appeared here. So that means that d gamma dE lab of the pion for a right-handed tau is proportional just to E lab. And if you redo this exercise for a tau polarized in the other direction, this is a linear function with just the opposite slope. So it's E max minus E lab. So this kind of slope for a right-handed tau, this kind of slope for a left-handed tau. OK, now, if you go measure the energy distribution of the pions that come from tau decays, you can then sort out what the polarization of the taus was. And if you look on the next slide, which is, please excuse me. Figure 11, page 11. On the left-hand side, you'll see that distribution. So it's a linear function. In the graph, it's fit as a sum of these two components. And there are just more of the left-handed guys than the right-handed guys. And if you extract the asymmetry from that and similar measurements, then you'll get a number for a tau that you can compare to the one in the table. Actually, you should take all of these modes. For the leptonic modes, it's pretty easy to see the effect. The electron or the muon in weak interactions is always left-handed. So when that guy preferentially would be emitted forward for a left-handed tau and backward for a right-handed tau. And you see that reflected on the curve on the right, which is for muons. So when you put all this together, what you find is that a tau is equal to, again, one of these very accurate high statistics numbers, 0.1465 plus or minus 0.032. OK. Now, for the electron, we can't really measure the helicity of a 45 GeV electron. But we can do something else, which is to measure the asymmetry of electron production of the Z. So at SLAC, my colleagues measured AE in this way by making a left-handed polarized electron beam and making Zs out of that, and then making a right-handed polarized electron beam, and then computing the asymmetry in this way. OK. Well, making a polarized beam is very tricky. If you put electrons into a synchrotron and send them around tens of thousands of times, what happens is that any polarization you put in gets randomized unless you're extremely careful. I don't think anyone has actually succeeded in doing this at an energy above 10 GeV. Lep did it with a single beam, but of course a single beam is pointless because then you can't collide it with another beam. At SLAC, this was done in the following way. To have a different kind of collision setup, which is shown, I think, on figure 12, where you take the big linear accelerator, you build two arms, you run the electrons and positrons down the linear accelerator, a process that, by the way, preserves the longitudinal polarization, and then you take them off and you collide them immediately before anything can happen to that polarization. Now, you need a source of polarization, and the device for that is shown in figure 13. So what you see there is a set of laser beams. You have a special solid-state material, a strained gallium arsenide cathode. So that slightly splits the energy levels for electrons of different spin. You come in with a circularly polarized photon. It ejects the electron of that spin. A bunch of electrons with that polarization then get accelerated, and then they go down and into this apparatus. The very cool thing about this experiment is there's a little cell there that's the circular polarizer on which you can put a randomly coded signal. And so roughly you change the voltage on that cell in a random way, and then 4 kilometers over there the cross-section changes in response to it, and you measure that. So this is about the closest thing to a systematics-free experiment that you could possibly do in particle physics. And the answer that comes out from that is that you do actually see a polarization asymmetry. The number is consistent with this one. It's 0.513 plus or minus 0.0021. And both of them consistent with this prediction of the A sub lepton that I've given you before. OK, well, there's something which is very cool about this particular quantity. So let's just compute it in the SU2 cross U1 model. It's a half minus sine squared theta W squared minus sine squared theta W squared divided by half minus sine squared theta W squared plus sine squared theta W squared. So this is the Q left and the Q right for a lepton. In the numerator, we get a quarter minus sine squared theta W. And in the denominator, we'll get 2 sine to the fourth theta W plus a quarter minus sine squared theta W. OK, now I told you that sine squared theta W is 0.23. So that's incredibly close to a quarter. So if I just make that approximation here, this becomes 8 times a quarter minus sine squared theta W. So if I take this number here and divide it by 8, that measures the difference between a quarter and sine squared theta W. And so what that means is that the measurement of this number gives you an incredibly accurate value of sine squared theta W. And so here's the number, sine squared theta W is equal to 0.23153 plus or minus 0.00016. Maybe I should say you should use these numbers with care because clearly the radiative corrections are going to be important when we try and use this number to predict any other process. But nevertheless, all these quantities seem to be able to be measured with incredible degrees of precision. Now, finally, there's one more A that I wanted to tell you about, which is the A sub D, or rather the A sub B. It's a little hard to figure out which ZDKs have down quarks and which have up quarks, because those just make lots of pions. But once again, if we have bottom quarks in the final state, then we can look for the vertices, and we can find those events, and we can try and study them. Now, if you also, by the technique that I described, have polarized beams, then you can do something else, which is, you guys remember from the first week of the course that the cross-section d sigma d cosine theta for a left-handed electron to make a left-handed quark is proportional to 1 plus cosine theta squared. And the cross-section for a left-handed electron to make a right-handed quark is 1 minus cosine theta squared. So roughly, if you have a left-handed electron beam, all the particles that go forward are left-handed bottom quarks, and all the particles that go backward are right-handed bottom quarks. So if you can tell the B from the B bar, which maybe I should emphasize is not very easy, then to that extent, you should see a big forward peak for left-handed beams. Yes? No, there's an R here, and there's a minus sign here. OK, so the important point is this is an R, and this is a minus sign. So this is a very forward peak cross-section. This is a very backward peak cross-section. OK, so now what this predicts is that if the asymmetry is close to maximal, which is what the SU cross U1 theory says, then when you produce Bs from a left-handed beam, there should be a big forward peak. And when you produce Bs from a right-handed beam, there should be a big backward peak. And of course, eventually you get confused on a lot of events because it's not so easy to tell a B from a B bar. But anyway, the data is on the next figure, which I guess is figure 13. And it's true. And when you actually fit that data and put in your estimate of your confusion between B and B bar, the number is AB is equal to 0.92 plus or minus 0.02. And so that's, again, an interesting confirmation of the things in that table. This asymmetry is 15% for leptons, but it's close to 0.95 for bottom quarks. Okay, well, now in figure 15, what you see is a more complete table of all the observables that were measured in these precision Z0 experiments. And frankly, the whole thing is really pretty impressive. A lot of these numbers, you have the fourth significant figure. And further, the deviation from the predictions of the standard model is shown in those bar graphs. So this is the deviation in standard deviations from the best fit parameters of the standard model. You always expect that in a table like this that there'll be an outlier. But frankly, this is really spectacular agreement between theory and experiment. So yeah, we really understand the theory of strong interactions, of weak interactions. I'd just like to discuss a couple more topics in this theory. And I'll just really just mention them. I think one of them I gave you on the homework. If I now go to higher energy, if I look, for example, at the process E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus, we computed this before with the diagram where there's just gamma exchange. But when we get to energies of order mz, I need to add to this the diagram with z exchange. I have to add those diagrams coherently, and there's interference between them. That interference produces a forward-backward asymmetry. That is, the mu minuses tend preferentially to go forward at high energy, the mu pluses to go backward relative to the electron beam, even when it's unpolarized. So on the next slide, you'll see the theoretical prediction for that curve and also some data, I think, from the Opal experiment. And you'll notice that that forward-backward asymmetry curve has a quite non-trivial shape. It goes through a real resonance glitch at the mass of the Z. And you'll also notice that the data is in very good agreement with it. So I think I asked you to generate that curve on problem 2 of the homework. The other thing that I wanted to tell you is about another process that occurs in E plus E minus at high energy, which is E plus E minus to W plus W. So this goes through a set of three diagrams. First of all, the two that I've drawn here. And secondly, a diagram where I have T-channel neutrino exchange. And here I have the standard charge-changing weak interaction vertex. Now, this calculation has a very odd history. In the 1950s, when the V minus A theory was written, people didn't know about these diagrams. But they knew how to compute this one, because this vertex here, you can get directly from the V minus A theory and the postulate that there is a W boson. So ordinarily, you would expect that this cross-section has a magnitude which is some number times the point cross-section, pi alpha squared over s times some factor. But when people computed this cross-section, they found out that it was much larger at high energy, with an extra factor of s minus over mw squared. That is four powers of the energy higher than the naive prediction. And people said, well, this is just wrong, because a cross-section that large would violate the bounds on the size of scattering amplitudes that come from Unitarian. So there was a lot of question about how this process could possibly be made right. Well, it turns out, there's a little more to the story in the notes, that when you compute these diagrams, and you use exactly the form of the vertex that occurs in Young-Mills theory, there's a beautiful cancellation, and this factor goes away. And that cancellation, maybe I should emphasize, depends on the particular form of the vertex that comes from the Young-Mills theory description of the weak interaction. OK, well, what does experiment say about that? Well, finally, we have the measurements from LEP, and they're shown on the final slide. And so those purple and red curves are where you leave out one or the other of these diagrams. The blue curve is where you include the complete standard model calculation, and the data is the data. So once again, it really works. And it's a very beautiful confirmation, not only that we understand the couplings down here in the theory, but also that we understand the nonlinear three vector boson couplings in this theory. OK. Well, this now almost completes our survey of our experimental knowledge of the standard model of particle physics. There's one more little chapter which I'd like to tell you about, and we'll do that next time. So thank you very much.